Hi there, and welcome to Putting the Squid to Bed, a podcast about creative people and their craft. My name is Tim Lenko. I'm a writer and performer, and on this podcast, I interview creative people about why they create things and how they go about it. The show is named after an image that I have found so helpful. If you're anything like me, you know those moments when you've nearly finished a project, but then you find another touch you could add, another loose end to tie off, or another rough patch that needs ironing out. It's like trying to tuck a squid into bed. Just when you get two or three arms under the covers, another four or five have popped back out. Projects are rarely finished so much as they are surrendered. And that journey of discovery, creation, and surrender is what I ask my guests about. Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Putting the Squid to Bed. In case we haven't met, hi, I'm Tim. And those of you who've been listening for a while know that I love having musicians on the show. And the one that I am looking at on the screen today is a gem that I genuinely love. My guest is, he grew up in taking piano lessons in small town Saskatchewan and has gone on to perform over 100 shows every year across Canada, Europe, Latin America. The rootsy storytelling of his songs has the power to transport a listener out onto a lake in Canada's north or to the main street of a prairie town. He was a student of the Royal Conservatory of Music and received his licentiate diploma in piano performance from Trinity College, London, when he was only 19. And since then, he's fused his classical chops with inspiration from acts like fellow Sask native Joni Mitchell and been churning out infectious folk roots, singer-songwriter pop since then. To date, he has 10 albums and has toured internationally throughout the Netherlands, England, Mexico, Nunavut, and more. And in 2014, and I'm excited to ask him about this, he got an international boost coming from winning the prestigious Viña del Mar International Song Festival in Chile, representing Canada. And so it sounds to me a bit like the South American Eurovision.
A bit.
A little bit. Okay, I can't wait. We're going to get him in here so we can actually hear his voice more. You've gotten a sneak peek. Please welcome into your ears, Jeffrey Straker.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate being here. This is fun.
Oh, it's a genuine pleasure. I'm so glad you're here.
Yeah.
Where are you calling in from today?
I am in beautiful Regina, Saskatchewan, in the Cathedral neighborhood, in my home, in this neighborhood where I spend most of my home days these days.
Excellent. I see an upright piano behind you. Is there a story behind that one?
There is a bit. Her name is Moira Rose, and she was given to me as a gift about 7 years ago by a gal in Regina who listens to my music. And I floated out on social media at the time that I was looking for a good piano. And she emailed me and she said, I've got this old Heinzmann that I have looked after. Maybe this is one. And I'd been trying a lot of upright pianos. I knew I wanted a Heinzmann. I went over. And this thing was in mint condition. Amazing. Like, she had it in a humidified house. Moira sounded gorgeous. And I was like, I want her. So she gave me the piano. I just had to move it to my house. And then she wasn't called Moira off the hop. Okay. But during the pandemic, when, you know, the world shut down and we could only do shows from home, I was doing all these online shows. And I had her mic'd up. And at some point, I just sort of said, we've got to name this piano. So we had this contest. We got, I think there was like 1,000 suggestions of names.
Yeah.
And one person suggested Moira Rose. And I was like, that's it.
That's amazing. She's got a lot of character. And
she's got a lot of character.
A signature musical intuition.
Yeah, she does. She does. No, and without, I can't like not mention the Wurlitzer over here to my left as well.
Beautiful.
There's also a Wurlitzer that hails from a Weyburn, Saskatchewan.
Oh, yes. Great.
Yeah. So according to lore, it was once played, briefly owned by one Burton Cummings.
Oh, amazing.
So yeah. According to local lore.
Local lore. We do love Saskatchewan mythology like that.
Exactly.
Man. Okay, so I'm interested in the roots, if you'll pardon the pun, of you as a local myth. Where did you start out with music? When did you first get the sense that, oh, I actually love this?
Well, I mean, like many kids of my vintage, I was put into music lessons with a local music teacher when I was 7.
Yeah.
My teacher was Mrs. Young, Vicky Young, in Punishai, Saskatchewan. And the reason I was put into music lessons is that my mom and dad were quite musical. My mom was a piano player, specifically. Yeah. And my dad played the banjo, so we weren't going to start on banjo back in those days. You were going to start on piano. You know, it's like the foundation instrument, yeah. You know. And so we went to Mrs. Young, and we had this really forward-thinking principal in our local school, because our rural school division didn't have a music program. Mm. And because of that, he made it very clear that if you wanted to take a lesson from Mrs. Young, obviously on your own dime, you could simply walk out of whatever class you were in to go to your lesson with Mrs. Young in the house across the street where she set up for these lessons. And it was like, if you think about that now, this would never happen in a million years. Like, it could not happen.
Yeah.
But then, like, because he enabled it, it happened. And so I went to these lessons with Mrs. Young, and I wanted to learn. I really wanted to impress her.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, she was someone for me I wanted to impress.
Huh.
And so I would practice. Like, I practiced from my first lesson. I practiced, you know, 15 minutes at first, then half an hour. You know, like, but, you know, I really, not only did I want to impress her, I really enjoyed playing the piano. Like, I liked,
cool.
I liked the sound. I liked the feeling, you know, like making music was just something I just enjoyed.
Cool.
And so she kind of enabled the whole thing.
That's so great. Do you remember what it was about her that triggered that admiration and desire to impress her? And maybe there wasn't anything.
I mean, she was very lovely. Like, she had this incredible balance of love, and she's still alive, by the way. Like, she lives in Raymore, Saskatchewan.
Oh,
cool. She was very lovely. She was a really good teacher. Like, she had this incredible balance of pushing you along at the right pace while not overwhelming you, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and she was very encouraging, you know, while also expecting you to practice and get better. She did it in a way where you felt like you were being like, you know, like, sort of like, given this big hug, this musical hug.
Cool.
It's a gift, you know?
Yeah.
Not all teachers can do this.
No.
And then, as a testament to, you know, where she came from as a teacher, I got to a certain level where she's like, nope, you're beyond my piano level now. I want to send you to the next town to this next teacher, whose name was Don McTavish, because Don's teaching at a higher level, and I really think you would get a lot from that. So she's like, out you go. And then I went and, you know, took from this other lady. But, you know, Mrs. Young did it, you know. She probably, to be fair, she could have kept me longer. She could have, because she did teach at a higher level. But she just thought, you know, there's something about you, and I think this gal in the next town, I think you would really work well. So, she, you know, she sent me off. Now, as I was saying that, I was thinking, like, maybe she was getting rid of me. I never thought of that before.
Well, Mrs. Young,
but I don't.
If you're out there listening, write in. Let us know if it's bad news.
Call in now.
Yeah, call in right now. Oh, that's great. I can't picture anyone wanting to get rid of you. So it's highly unlikely that that was the case.
Well, and so then, I mean, I did, just to finish the arc there, I went and I did study with Mrs. McTavish in the next town for, you know, I'll say 5 or so years. And then, what happened was I was playing in music festivals, like the local district music festival. And I was a big practicer, so I was doing quite well in these festivals. And then one of the adjudicators, who would always come in from somewhere else, was this guy, Frank Crumley, who was the head of the piano department at the University of Regina Conservatory of Music. And then Don talked to Frank, and they were like, you know, I think this guy would benefit from being at the conservatory. So then I went and studied with Frank for 4 more years, I think.
Great.
So there I was.
Cool.
But yeah, I you know, enjoyed it the whole way through.
Yeah.
Practiced like a madman. Probably too much, as I think about it, like in hindsight. But like, you don't know it at the time because you're in so far. But like, I was practicing 4 or 5 hours a day at the end.
Yeah.
Like, it was pretty bonkers.
Yeah. Well, and that's resulted in like, you're one of the best keys players that I've heard live. Which is really, really fun.
God.
So it's paid off, because you've got this great like mixture of accuracy and passion and like this gospely soul-y color that you put into it. It's not just It's not just straight across the board, just accurate. That's it. There's soul there.
Nice. I mean, I hope so. But you know, isn't it weird though? Like you raise an interesting thing. Like anybody who plays any instrument, your output is the sum of your inputs. And you don't know this while you're going along at a young age. But at some point, all the stuff you take in, like what comes out of you, is going to be the result of what you've taken in, yeah. Right? So it's funny.
No kidding. Yeah. So to say all that, like you, the output that you've got is now really, really loved by so many people. When you say that you maybe practiced too much, what kind of signals are you seeing that make you think that? Like, were there things you were missing out on?
No, I mean, I think what makes me say that is, like, I don't think I missed out on anything, but I mean, I was practicing, you know, a lot, like 4 or 5 hours a day. Not every day, but like I was getting there, right? It was driving myself probably a bit crazy. But I mean, and I was doing it in like, and I would never begrudge the technique that I gained from that, because I know I have pretty good technique from doing, like, after you do that for all that, like that, it's that 10,000 hours thing, right? Yeah. But I mean, I was doing it in the context of a conservatory with a classical teacher, where I think possibly in his mind, and I never even thought about what my end goal was. He kind of thought, well, you're obviously going to go on to university and study piano. And then when I got my licentiate diploma, mm-hmm. which was not bad for a 19-year-old. I mean, I finally stopped and thought, and I was like, I don't want to be a classical pianist. Like, it was like, I finally paused, uh-huh. You know. So it's only in that context where I kind of thought, like, you know, I probably could have practiced less, you know. Yeah. Like, but I mean, at the same time, I loved it so much that I don't even know why I would say that. So, you know, it's hindsight's 20/20, right?
That makes sense. So after all of that investment in classical piano training, you did take a turn into folk roots, writing your own stuff, composing your own songs. Tell me about that turn.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I guess it was kind of unexpected in a way. Like, I had moved to Toronto for a job. I got out of music. I actually went and did a science degree, and then I got out. Then I also didn't do science. I went and had a marketing job in Toronto. Yeah. Some people would say scattered. I would say Renaissance man.
Yes.
but there I was in Toronto, and what I didn't know I was getting myself into in moving to Toronto was stumbling into this land where there was this huge singer-songwriter scene, and I would go to these bars, and there were these people playing these songs that they'd written, and it was all about the words, generally. Mm. Like, I would say, and some people might chastise me for this, but I would say of the people I heard, like, no one was really an incredible musician. You know, they could accompany themselves, and it's not, that's not slighting people, because that wasn't the point. The point was telling a story through words, you know, backed by music in a way. That's what I was seeing anyway. Yes. And I was taken by it, and I was enthralled by it. And I thought, gosh, like almost like, what is this? Because, you know, this is a different era. Like, you know, like you have to, like, I didn't have a Facebook account at the time. You know, like, this is like, we're going back here. And like, so like, I had never really stopped. I mean, I was aware that songs I was hearing, obviously someone wrote them.
Right.
But I mean, you know, but I wasn't aware that that could be me. Like, you know, like no one ever stopped and poked me on the shoulder and said, have you ever thought about writing a song?
Yeah.
Because I hadn't. And then there I was seeing these people, and I was like, oh, I think I want to try this, you know, like, and then, you know, I did. And the first ones were obviously pretty bad. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. And then, you know, I would sing a few at open mics in Toronto. There were like open mic nights at certain venues, like Say What or the Free Times Cafe or the Rivoli or these places or the Holy Joe's. Like, there were these venues that some people might recognize, and they were really fun. And you know, you were really just getting your feet wet. But then some over time, you sort of see people coming back, and then every now and then someone would say, "Well, you once sang this one. Can you sing that again?" And then like, it slowly builds, you know, and then, but I did have a point though, where I realized I was like, I'm not a good, I almost said great, then I changed it to good, like good or great singer. I could play piano, but I was like, and I was getting into word writing, but I was like, I'm not a great singer. And I had never taken a singing lesson, and some people never do. Right. But I was like, oh, I think maybe I should consider that. And strangely, the flat I was living in, the guy through the wall was a singer-songwriter, and he heard me singing and playing the piano, and I was on my deck one day, and he was on his deck, and we were chatting over the deck, and I said, hey, his name was Jeff, too, and I said, hey, Jeff, I'm thinking about taking some singing lessons. He said, I'm taking singing lessons. He said, it's this woman named Elizabeth. She lives in the Junction. Here's her number. And I called up Elizabeth, and I ended up taking lessons from her for 3 years. We are still fierce and fast friends.
Oh, great.
Like, she is, like, one of the loveliest people I know. Sorry to all the other lovely people I know.
But she's, you know, she's really lovely. She's the top of the heap, yeah.
She's the top of the heap. And, you know, and I stopped, and she was a trained opera singer, so she knew all the technique, and I really learned a lot. And there were some real turning points vocally with her in those lessons. And singing is a very different beast than playing the piano, and it was a wonderful experience, and it helped me evolve as a singer-songwriter.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Because that's a whole different kettle of fish.
It truly is. And you're right about how some people never take a lesson in their lives, and there are certain they have a certain access to, or they naturally develop a technique or a set of techniques that really, really work for them and really produce a great sound, an effective sound that connects with people. And then there's a lot of the rest of us who really benefit from technique that's coached, is taught to us by other people. I'm really glad for that fortuitous connection.
Yeah, on the patio deck. And you know, it's really funny. Like, I think of Elizabeth often, and one of the reasons, there are many reasons, but one of them is that, like, if I'm vocally tired, if I'm on tour or something, if I've had 3-4 shows in a row, and at that point, no matter, any human being is going to get a bit vocally tired. It happens to everybody.
Yes.
When you're singing a couple sets, like, the training I got from her in terms of warming up your voice and how to sing through a tired voice, like, It's
priceless.
Like, it's not foolproof, but it's pretty close. Like, you can go from, like, I can't sing this show to, like, I can sing this show. You know, like, if you just do the right things.
Yes.
And, you know, it's all her. Like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's so good. Okay, so, first of all, I agree. The times that I've been a little unwell and then leaned more heavily on technique have been better. Much better than times that I'm well. And I'm like, okay, well, I can just kind of cruise.
Yeah.
Some people talk about this experience where it's false health or false wellness, like, or stage health, where they could be deathly ill in the wings and then they go out on stage and some adrenaline hits and this false sense of or temporary sense of their system being well and well equipped and well oiled is there for the duration of their performance, and then they're deathly ill again when they walk off stage. Have you experienced that as well?
Yeah, I have. Like, I actually honestly think one of the times I was just reminded of this, was the last show I did in Moose Jaw in the May Wilson Theater.
Yeah.
And because I had a cold and my voice just, like, wasn't working the day before. And I was like, oh God, I'm gonna have to cancel the show. And I never cancel shows. I was like, this is just not working. And I did all the warm-ups and everything that night. And I was like, oh, I think this got better. I'll see what happens the next day. And it was questionable.
Okay.
And even when I got to Moose Jaw, I was warming up and I was like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. And we started the show and I was like, I don't know where this is coming from. But this is like, somehow it's gone away, you know? And then as soon as the show was done, I was like, oh God, it's back. Like, isn't it? It's the weirdest thing.
Yeah. But such a gift. I'm glad for the timing of it. I'm glad it works. Out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So before you ever get on stage to and see if your voice will actually show up for you, you write prolifically. And I'd love to hear a little bit about your creative process. How do you go about that? Do you come in with a library of ideas that you've gathered throughout your life and you've just jotted them all down? Or do you come into a thing like, how am I feeling right now? Or do you come in with a story and then, you know, how do you start? And then how do you navigate through putting lyrics and music together when you're writing?
Yeah. Well, and it's a tricky question to even to ask, and it's an equally tricky question to answer, because I used to sort of have almost like a process in a way, like or I thought I did, and it's really changed over time, and I think it's because I've just sort of loosened the reins on it over time, because what I've realized, I think, thankfully, is that there's ideas everywhere, and I've also realized a thing about. I've discovered how I can, like, a thing that I can do. There's two things I can do, and I'll tell you what they are. To tap into ideas, like, it's just my psychology. Yeah. It's everyone has their thing. But first of all, I'm a very busy person. I kind of enjoy being busy. And obviously, I wouldn't say, like, I consciously do, but I find myself busy all the time. So there's some enjoyment I get out of being busy. And I make myself busy. So there's less time in being a busy person to be sitting down to write. And my conundrum is that I find I need blocked off chunks of time. Like my mind needs to know that there's time to really work on something.
Yeah.
Or I can't even get into it, you know? Uh-huh. So with that in mind, I do keep like a note page in my iPhone as well as voice memos. As ideas come in, I capture them.
Great.
And whether it's some of these lines end up being a title line, some end up being a verse line, whatever. They're just thoughts and ideas.
Yes.
And same with melody ideas, or sometimes I've got a lyrical idea with a melody. I'll sing that into a voice memo. And then when I do have time, or if I carve out time, I go into this pool and I sort of harvest it. And I see, like, what's catching... With the benefit of time having gone by, when I go back to these things, what's catching my attention here? And it's really funny how some of the ones that in the moment seemed amazing, you go back and you're like, well, that's garbage. it's not catching my attention whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what about it in the moment was interesting. But some of them really stand out, you know? Mm-hmm. And related to this, one of the things I've discovered about me, like, generating ideas or accessing ideas or thoughts or whatever is movement. And one is I'm a runner. And so, like, I really, really enjoy running. And I have this sort of route that I do in Regina. It's about 8 kilometers, and I do it 3 to 4 times a week, and it's around Wascana Lake. And I just find it, awesome. It's my consciousness turns off, for better or for worse. I'll sometimes, like, snap into consciousness and be like, how the heck did I get here? Like, it's really weird. And what I find, though, is when my consciousness turns off, my subconsciousness engages, and the good stuff is in your subconscious. Mm. Like that's where ideas are, right? And so I get kind of almost like flooded with ideas when I'm running. A similar thing happens to me when I'm on airplanes, strangely, because I'm not having to, like, in a car I get it less because I'm driving and doing something.
Yeah.
But in an airplane, I'm just like, something's lifting me up, and I'm just kind of like, you know, taking off, carried. Whatever. And and my brain does the same thing on airplanes. So I get a lot of ideas on airplanes too.
Great.
But so I capture these down, and then when I carve out time, I typically like to be at a piano.
Mm.
And then I muck with it. So that's kind of a sort of a summary, I guess, if you will, of my general process. But I mean, there's a million variables of how that can, you know, play out. But that's the gist of how I find things have been going lately.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're saying that it's been a change to something, you know, loosening the reins, letting a lot more of that just mucking around be freer and just reach out and see what happens, what fits together. So it isn't a predictable sequence of putting together.
Yeah, because, like, there's something about the spark and the magic you feel when you get the idea.
Yeah.
And then, like, there's something about that spark and that magic that, like, when you go park that in an iPhone for 6 weeks and come back to it, like, sometimes you remember that you when you reread or re-listen to the idea, you feel that spark and magic again, which is great. That's kind of a way for me to tell, like, oh, this is working or not working, right? But even so, then when you go to develop it, like, the conundrum is, like, how do you, like, you can come up with something, like, pretty, like, say, within quick, like, an hour or two or whatever. You could get a song, for example. But, like, is it done? Should it be rewritten? Should you work on it? And this is that whole... Because it's been said, no great song was ever written, it was rewritten. It's also been said by people like Dolly Parton, who allegedly wrote I Will Always Love You and Jolene in the same day, that striking while the iron's hot is where the magic is. Like, so somewhere between those two ideas is where you try to be. Like, you can't... Like, there's a point of rewriting something and editing something to death that you're gonna unfortunately work the spark out of it.
Totally.
But, you know, but somewhere along that way, you could find it and amplify it a little bit and turn that spark into a fire. But it's like, you know, figuring out where too much is and where to let go and where to stop. Like, that's the beauty of the creative process. Like, that's why people do it. That's what makes artists be artists or songwriters be songwriters. Like, that's it. Like, I really, like... get off on the creative process. Like, it's just, it's the most wonderful thing, you know? So even though I've built this sort of like way for me to be like, okay, I know that when I'm in motion, I can get into my subconscious and get ideas, etc. But it still comes down to sitting down at my piano and being like, okay, I've got this nugget of an idea, but where's it going?
Yeah.
I got this one that came to me, I'll tell you, and if I feel weirdly like I'm now committing that this has to become a song. But my great grandma, who has long since passed away, her name was Meta Matilda Straker, and her family immigrated to Canada from Nebraska at the turn of the century. She was American. And some of her friends called her Matilda. To me, she was great grandma. But I've been thinking a lot about that for some reason recently. And I've got this idea in my brain of Matilda's suitcase, because she talked about leaving the farm in Nebraska because her dad was like, we're going to Canada. And apparently they had a really lovely ranch acreage in Nebraska. He's like, we're going to Canada. There's more opportunity there. We can't grow anymore here. She had friends. She had a pony. She had a farm. She had familiarity. And she had to pack into one suitcase what she could take and get on a train to Winnipeg. And I've been thinking about Matilda's suitcase. And I'm positive Matilda's suitcase is going to become a song. Yeah. But, like, that's one teeny tiny idea. What's the song around Matilda's suitcase? I don't know. But, like, I literally can't wait to sit at that piano and figure it out, you know?
Yeah. So if someone were to, if they were a fly on the wall, on that lovely green wall right there, and they were to watch you noodling around, what would they see? Would they see you throwing out different lines, singing different things, and playing different chord progression, just iterating and reiterating? Or would you be like writing down a bunch of notes and then trying things? How would it look?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily write down like music notes at all ever. It's typically just like words and chords, and there is a melody of notes being written, but it's just that's typically in my head. Like, I've never written down the melodies for very few songs.
Yeah.
So I am trying different chords. I'm trying different time signatures. Mm-hmm. I'm trying different keys, because the key can obviously influence the melody depending on your vocal range. But I'm kind of a lyric first person, probably to a fault. But I love the stories in people's songs. And in fact, I've probably stopped listening to some people I used to listen to because I've just become more story-oriented now.
Yeah.
And it's not that these people have changed doing what they're doing. I just realized I love stories and songs.
Yeah.
And so I've just sort of migrated to people who are putting stories in songs. Like, that's kind of what I'm listening to, right?
Who are some of those people that are doing stories in song and you love it?
Well, let's see. Who will pop to mind when you ask that question? I would say Alison Russell is one who comes to mind. Donovan Woods is one. There's a guy from Manitoba. He's like an alt country guy, and Del Barber.
Okay.
He's like a roots country guy. His story songs, I think, are so fantastic. Stephen Fearing, who's from the West Coast. There's a guy I just saw in Saskatoon, James Keelahan. He's a folkie.
What a great name.
And they're story songs.
Yes.
And this guy James was touring with, who I'd never heard before. His name was Jez Lowe from England. And he was just this nondescript 60-year-old white man. I don't know, like, just this guy. But I mean, you know, and I wouldn't have known about him except he was touring with James. And I was just blown away by his storytelling, you know. And he had this song called, I think it was called Louisa or something about Louisa, but it was about this guy he had met whose name was Louis, who moved to America and then came back to England, who he'd transitioned into Louisa. And it was just this beautiful story, you know, like told by this guy through a song, you know, this who I thought was like this, you know, middle-aged straight white man who you just wouldn't expect this wonderful story to come from. And so these stories and songs, I think as a vehicle of storytelling, I think it'll never get old. Like,
no.
For me anyway, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and since the dawn of humanity, storytelling around the fire on the cave walls, like, it's in our blood.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So for you, as you're, you know, finding these stories and crafting these stories, what do you respond to the most? What kind of stories, some people theorize that different storytellers essentially find new ways to tell the same story over and over because they're working out something that's in their soul. So some filmmakers or songwriters might be telling this same story over and again. Like they might be telling Love Against Impossible Odds.
Right.
Or the long journey to their father over that, you know, impossible gap. Or, you know, can true love heal a broken heart kind of thing? Or loss of everything you love, like the same story. Do you get a sense of like themes in your stories that you keep getting drawn to?
Yeah, there are themes for sure, but I think they've changed over time. Yeah. And so when I first started, there was really a theme of the underdog. Like one of the first, and it was always third person. Like it was never me, but I think it was probably me. You know what I mean? It wasn't me, but it was probably me.
It's like, safer that way.
It's way safer that way, you know?
A degree of separation.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also something about, you know, I probably my comfort level at the time was, like I'm a real observer of things around me. And I'm also a really good listener. Like people tell me stuff about themselves all the time. Mm. And I'm like, you are telling me a lot. I mean, I'm not judgy at all, but I love hearing people's stuff, and I don't judge, and I'll sometimes just try to play back tidbits and making sure I'm understanding, but I love listening, you know? Anyway, for whatever reason, when I was first writing my first songs, there were a lot of underdogs. Like I had this song, one of the first ones on my first record. It's called The Wonderful Mrs. Bell, about a lady of East Indian descent who lived in my little prairie town. And she was very traditional. She wore a sari. And she just looked really different. And just how I perceived her life in my little prairie town. Someone who was different. I had a song about this guy who was in my class from grade 1 to 12 who was gay, even though he wouldn't have probably identified as gay, obviously, when he was in grade 1 or 2. But it turned out, you know, eventually he was gay, which I didn't know I was at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, by the time I wrote the song, I did. But, I mean, telling his story about how I sort of like saw him be this, like he triumphed being out. Like he successfully lived a pretty good, you know, accepted life in this small rural Saskatchewan town in the 80s and 90s, which some would say that can't be done. Yet he navigated in a way. And I just think it's just something worth celebrating. So, you know, he's an underdog in one of my early songs. So I had a lot of these underdog songs. And then, growing up where I grew up on a grain farm on the prairies, like some songs, even on my first record, were about rural life on the prairies. And that has been a theme through all of my years. It kind of went away for a while. I think I convinced myself that I'd either A, sung about it too much, or that wasn't something that could appeal to audiences outside of the prairies. Therefore, why should I sing about it? Which is a foolish conclusion, you know. But you know, we all go through,
of course,
funny things. And then my mom passed away early 2019, and I had a whole record dealing with that. Basically, that was big. And I've kind of wound my way back on my record that's about to come out in June 2024. It's a very prairie record, you know. But the interesting thing is that each time I'm trying to figure out the title of my album, I never until that moment pause to think, what have these songs been about? And then when I'm titling the album or attempting, and it always takes me way too much time. Like I'll take days trying to think of the title of the stupid record. Because I'm trying to sum up, what was this about? Yeah. Because I never, like, I work on the ideas themselves.
Yeah.
And I don't know if other people are different, but I mean, it's not like I'm writing a musical where I'm trying to make them all hang together. Like these are just songs.
Yeah.
But me as an artist at a place in time, at a place in my life, at a geographic place, there is something that binds these together. And so then when I title them, I try to title like what is this about? And what I have found, which is this is going back to your question, is like I find thematically that has changed over time, yet I find that where I've got to now is almost where I started. You know, some very prairie songs, some underdog songs. Like, it's kind of fascinating, you know?
Oh, interesting. I can't wait to hear the rest of it. You've got one single out from it. Is the time you've got from that album, or is it, on its own?
No, it's going to be from that album.
Okay, yeah. Excellent. So yeah, The Time You've Got came out on March 5th, and it's beautiful. I love it.
Oh, thanks.
I want to say that one of the things that I love about the story that it tells is that it resists this cynicism about love that is just, you know, endemic among us, because like we've all been so burnt and it's been so diluted and so dehumanized through technologically mediated romantic ventures.
Yeah.
And so cynicism is everywhere, but this song is just so, you know what? There's such a wholesome, dear optimism that is really leaning into, without being saccharine.
Hopefully.
Like,
you hit the nail on the head of what we were hoping for. I co-wrote this song with Beverly Mahood.
Okay.
And another artist, a guy, artist, co-writer of hers named Max Shepard. So we wrote the song together, but we did, like, these things you're talking about, like, you're a very astute listener. We talked about this, and because the song throws out a challenge in a way to the listener. Yeah. Like, it literally says, like, you know, in like, hopefully it says it in a more poetic way than this, but what it says is, given that time is finite, what are you doing with yours? And in doing that, it kind of encourages. It says, like, you know, if you have some apologies to make, go do it now. Like, take a leap. Who knows where you're going to land? Go find out. Don't wait. Like it sort of, in a poetic way, hopefully, yes, gives this list of things you might want to consider trying. But we didn't want to be, like, saccharine about it. Yeah. But I love that you I think you said wholesome or something. But, like, we wanted it to be, like, a big hug. Yeah. But it's hard to give a, you know, urge people to be, like, it's like, hey, like, time's ticking, but 2011.
An urgent hug.
Exactly. Like, how do you do that, right? But so I've got feedback from people on the song. People have messaged me, and it's been really lovely to read what they've heard, you know?
That's
like,
great.
Because you toss this stuff out into the world, and you cross your fingers, because at the end of the day, if you're writing it on your own, or you with your co-writers, you get to the end, where you're like, this song is done.
Yeah.
And then I recorded it, mm-hmm. and you're like, well, this feels good for me. All I can do is just hope that this resonates with listeners. I mean, at the end of the day, an artist who paints a picture and feels good about it, they can just hopefully get it up in a gallery and say, I hope this resonates with some eyeballs. You know, like, yes, that's kind of how it is. It's really weird.
Totally.
But, yeah.
Were you surprised at all by any of the things that people said, what they heard and what resonated for them?
Well, not on this one yet,
because
this one is so new. Yes. I mean, this song's only been out in the world for 2 days.
Yeah.
But one of them that was, so it's, I released, the previous tune that I released was called Sing Your Song. Interestingly, also a co-write. There's only two co-writes on this record, and the last two that I released were the co-writes. And that song, Sing Your Song, it's not a dissimilar theme to The Time You've Got. But interesting, co-wrote this song with a gal from Ottawa named Lynn Miles. She's a wonderful folk songwriter, and put it out there, shot this video near Moose Jaw, incidentally, with a real piano out on a pond in a field, frozen pond. And the video is very eye-catching, and I'm wearing this red suit, so it got a...
Totally,
got some,
I've seen
views,
some clips. It looks beautiful.
But several people messaged me saying, oh, you've obviously read some Brené Brown books. And I was like, I don't know who Brené Brown is. So I was like, I don't know what these people are talking about. So I quickly went and bought some Brené Brown books. And I'm reading these books, and this woman is like, she's like a superstar at what she does, you know? Like, this book's called The Art of Imperfection, and I'm reading it right now, and it's like a wonderful book. You know it.
It's so good. Yes, I do.
So good, right? And I realized, I was like, this song is, like, my song, or our song is essentially her book, you know? Like, it's kind of fascinating. But so, and people message me often or leave comments saying, well, like, I love how this song is about this. And that's totally not what it was about. But I'm like, yeah, it is. Because, like, if that's what it is to them, then that's what it is, you know? Like, that's the beauty of some songs. I mean, some songs are more specific, you know, and but some of them are written in a way where it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And I really like that about some of them.
Totally. Well, and that happens anytime someone is, you know, subjectively coming to something. Their present moment, their story that they're in at that moment ends up filtering. It ends up being a lens through which you see things. And so you're going to be creating a thing and seeing it through the lens. You're going to be producing it through the lens that you're seeing things through, but then other people will filter it differently. And it's like any experience, an event could be experienced by different people, different ways. So that does make a lot of sense. And what an interesting... What an interesting thing to start seeing the grains of the universe that are present in the things that we produce that other people will recognize, even though we weren't seeing it. But because we're all a part of this same story, this same cosmos, it's all there throughout all of it, whether we intentionally put it there or not. If we're telling the truth, that's the one thing that I think.
If
we're creating something that is... to the best of our ability, reflecting truthfully on whatever we're seeing and processing, then those honest grains of the universe, I think, will be there because the truth is the truth.
Totally. And you know, that just made me, this is what you just said made me think of this. Like, there's a song on my last record. It's a very small town Saskatchewan song called One Foot on Main Street. And it's a song, it's essentially the song is about like myself and all these people who came from small towns. So many of us have moved away from them. But, you know, and these small towns are often dying. But we've gone on and done our thing. But that small town has remained such a part of us. And so the song is called I've Still Got One Foot on Main Street.
That's
beautiful. I toured England in 2022. And I was like, well, I'm not going to sing this song because no one's going to get this song there. But I trotted it out at one show. And everyone was like, oh, my God, you're singing about England. And I was like, what? And they're like... This is happening here. They're like, people are moving out of small towns, and these small town people are living in cities, longing for these towns that can't support them anymore. I was like, I had no idea, you know? So, but to your point, I was thinking about something that meant a lot to me. And it's a very true song, you know? And it's not just about leaving a town. It's about this feeling of like sense of purpose and sense of belonging and stuff. And, you know, and it's, so it's funny how it's what you said is so accurate. It's like, cause it's not like you're just in this place. You're part of this bigger thing, this bigger group of people who's in this same place, and they can tap into your message or parts of it. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, that is pretty neat. What a gift to be able to connect with people and connect with something larger than yourself through that.
It's kind of fun. Like, I mean, I certainly don't. I don't know if anyone sets out to do it, but it's sure neat to experience when it happens. You know.
Yeah. That's so cool.
So somewhat related to this, like probably the experience of the One Foot on Main Street song played into me feeling very comfortable about some of the songs I have on my upcoming record. And one of them, the track one, is called Some Say It's Just a Sky. And it's a song about, for me, being a prairie person, what the sky means to me. And I think the sky to people on the prairies has a very different meaning than someone in downtown Toronto. Because in downtown Toronto, frankly, you're rarely looking up at the sky.
Totally.
The buildings are on the way. But on the prairies, I mean, this thing above us is ever-changing, and it's really influencing everything around us. And it's this... It's really significant. For me, it's a song about a sky. For other people, hopefully, it's, you know, it's about other things. But anyway,
No.
This feeling of tapping into something larger is it's a big one, you know?
It is a big one, yeah. And there's a comfort in like being able to say, all right, I don't have to be responsible for the picture of this big one. Again, I'm subjectively rooted in the spot that I'm at, and I'm responsible for what's there in front of me. And I will happily discover how I'm connected to all of it and how what I'm seeing is threaded right through.
Yeah.
And so to that end, I don't know that you've said the name of the album yet. Is that public knowledge, or is that a fun surprise?
Say it. I've only said it once, but I can tell you what it's called.
Okay.
Interestingly, the record is called Great Big Sky.
Great Big Sky.
It's called Great Big Sky. And if all things go according to plan, tomorrow the vinyl should be arriving at my house.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah. So there's a real prairie undertone to the whole thing, and the sky is almost like a character in the record, so it felt appropriate to call it Great Big Sky.
Very cool. Is there a launch date or a drop date for when that's public?
I'm only saying early June, but it's within the first 2 weeks of June. The exact date is still to be pinned down, but if people, I would ask people to stay tuned because it'll be within the first 2 weeks of June.
Yes.
It will release on all the digital platforms. I'm going on tour in March, which might be by the time this airs.
This will drop early or mid April. So yeah. By that point,
so I will have gone on tour. Yes. Now I'm going on tour, and I'm pre-releasing CD and vinyl on that tour. So people on the tour route will be able to grab a copy, which I'm probably only announcing today. I've not talked about it yet. So, but yeah, it's fun because I mean we're kind of skipping out of the realm of writing songs here.
Yes.
But once you've written and recorded those songs, now the rules about how you should release it, like, there are no more rules. There's no standard, you know. Yeah. Like, it's like whatever you can dream up, just do it.
Yeah. Well, that seems like such a fun different, I don't think I've heard of that approach where you're going on tour right before it comes out and those folks are essentially, you know, the subscribers, the email list, like the insiders. Those ticket holders are the insiders who get first access. And that's very fun.
Yeah. And I mean, I can tell you something too, which I haven't talked about yet, but in June and July, I'm doing a very unorthodox album release tour, and it's only going to be in Saskatchewan, and it's going to be in 6 locations, and it's going to be concerts in grain elevators.
Incredible.
Because it's pretty weird, but
yes.
B, there's a song on the record called More Than 2x4s and Timbers, and it's about a grain elevator.
Okay.
And it's about what grain elevators mean to prairie people, Saskatchewan people in particular.
Amazing.
And I was like, I want to launch this record in grain elevators. So
yeah.
It's in the works. So people can watch for that. So
okay.
They'll be very small, like house concert type things in grain elevators.
That's excellent. Okay. Yeah. At the tail end of this episode, everyone, we're going to be like sharing Jeffrey's socials and his website and stuff. Make sure to follow him so that you can hear, because I think this will come out as or before those tickets will go on sale. That's exciting. That's something to miss.
No, it should be kind of neat, I think. I've never been to a show in a grain elevator.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I've got a good friend here in Moose Jaw who, as a hobby, photographs elevators as well as other rundown Saskatchewan buildings and the sky, actually. But he loves elevators. I'll send you his... I can't remember his socials name, but I'll send you his socials and we'll put it in the show notes at the bottom here. Andrew.
Yeah.
Andrew is his first name.
I would love to look at these.
Such good photography.
Oh, wow.
I love it. I smile so much every time it comes through my feed because he's got such a beautiful eye. He's a funeral director at the Moose Jaw Funeral Home, and he is an extraordinary photographer just for the love of it.
Isn't it amazing how, like, these old rundown elevators people find so magical?
Yeah.
Like... You know, there's something about them.
There is. Well, there's a connection to the roots of our whole, you know, what our province has been built on. Like, we're the breadbasket of Canada. And that has been our province's livelihood for a lot of years. And the fact that they're not in use, there's a bit of a distance to that that then, you know, increases the romance of it and increases our yearning. You know, it's like what you're saying, one foot on Main Street. There's that distance that increases that yearning. For the people who are attentive to where they're coming from.
Yeah. Huh. I love them. Anyway. So Great Big Sky, the record, and then and then this launch tour in elevator. So there you go.
Oh, that's so great. I cannot wait. I'll keep my eye out. I really want to be at one of those.
I hope so.
So in all of these things, the writing, the recording, maybe even when you are preparing your live shows, what are some of the biggest challenges that you face? What are the biggest obstacles that routinely pop up for you? And what are some of the things that you've discovered help navigate through them?
In no particular order, what's popping to mind here? So, like, in the writing process, I think, like, in creating, figuring out the balance of, like, when, like, I don't want to overwrite something. I don't want to overthink something. I want to keep the magic in it that was there when the idea came to me. And I sort of alluded to this a bit earlier, but I want to, like, the challenge is, like, knowing when it's done.
Yeah.
And, like, there's this nagging, I've talked to other songwriters about this, and typically the answer is very sort of common. And people, there's this nagging feeling you have in your gut when you kind of know. And sometimes a deadline will make you settle and move on, and it's just the worst. Because you're like, and every time you're saying it, you're like, it's not done. Like, you're like, something's not done about it. And you know when something's done, generally.
Yeah.
And I think the more you're right, the more you sort of understand what that sense is within you, because only you as the creator really know. So that, I struggle with that a bit, you know, like, trying to figure out, like, how do I maintain the magic while making sure I've, like, you know, given it enough time to develop it enough. Like, that balance is hard. Then when it comes to performing songs, I mean, it's interesting because it's a similar sort of theme. Like, there's this magic when you create a song, and there's this feeling when it's just done, right? So you're like, oh, and you sing it the first few times. And then if a song, it gets popular enough that you're putting it in a lot of set lists and playing it a lot of shows, like, after you've sung it for the 300th time, how do you keep that that fresh energy in a song you've sung 300 or 400 times?
Yeah.
You know, that's actually kind of tricky. But strangely, it is very possible. Like, it's a bit like method acting in a bit, but, like, you're not acting when you sing your song, really.
Yeah.
But if you let the song kind of carry you versus you trying to carry the song, it totally can happen where you can, you know, the 150th time can feel better than the first. Like, it's really funny. And so over time, sometimes maybe just acknowledging, with live music, you're not always in control of it. Like, if you're, you know, like, the music is kind of controlling you in a weird way. Like, it's, and controlling may be the wrong word. It's more carrying you. Like, it's, the music is
what
that
image.
You're there for, not you. You know, like, I think if you're giving it its dues, like people are there because this song, you as the deliverer of the song, but this song is what people are sort of drawn to. Like,
totally.
Let the song do the work and be there to serve that song. And if you know, if you can get out of its way, like, that's sort of when the magic sort of happens, you know? So, like, but I mean, that's easier said than done for me anyway. Like, I sort of struggle a bit with, like, because some nights, let's face it, you're just tired. And you've sang 5 nights in a row and you're like, I'd rather be dead. But here I am singing this show, you know? And then, you know, it might take you a few songs to get into it. And then you're like, oh, okay, now I remember why I'm here. Like, this feels really great. But, you know, it's not always easy when you're performing. Like, I saw a pretty well-known, I don't have to name the name, Canadian songwriter the other night, who was obviously exhausted. And it wasn't a great show. And I felt really sorry for them, because I think they knew it wasn't a great show. But I knew. It was like, oh, my God, I've felt that. Like, you know, but it's really hard sometimes. But so it's easy to say, oh, yeah, just let the music carry you and, like, that's that. But it's like, you know, when you factor in, like, fatigue and not eating right on the road and not, you know, like, you're not sleeping right, and, like, all these things, you know, you had an argument with your partner on the phone, like, an hour before you get on the stage. Like, these things happen. Like, it's life, right?
Truly.
And you gotta just, like, try to, as you're stepping onto the stage, to deliver these songs you've spent so much time writing and honing and working on, and that's what you really love the most. You gotta try to, like, park the rest of it at the edge of the stage to just, like, have this time with the people who are there to listen to your songs be that time.
Mm-hmm.
And let, because you people, I'm a firm believer that people don't, consciously people buy a ticket to a show, subconsciously people are buying tickets to a feeling. And they, like, they're there to feel. They're not, they're there to see a show. They're there to feel something. Like, and there's less and less feeling in us over time, for all the obvious reasons. And so if we can all just collectively, like, the performer and the audience, just, like, feel together, that's when everybody's going to walk away and be like, oh, my God, like, that was wonderful.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorite things about performing, too. This, like, it's oh, what is the phrase? It's this collaborative dynamic between the audience and the performers creating this moment and experience and this exchange and this energy in the room, and whether it's the suspension of disbelief for fictional performance or the musical feeling, that experience like that, that makes you forget that the rest of the world exists.
Yeah.
And elevates you while also rooting you. There's this both end of like being elevated up above the pedestrian, the simple where you are, but also being so deeply rooted in it. Mm-hmm. And that, what is it called? It's a conspiracy of something. Someone was talking about it. It's psychologically, it's akin to the, traffic lights and all the traffic signals in, traffic, because everybody is on the same page and they're creating this, synergistic, experience where everybody is safe because they all, you know, say, all right, yellow, red, and green lights don't mean anything, but we've all bought in together that they mean something and we're all in this together. Same with like performer audience. We've all bought in and together we're creating this magic.
Yeah.
Love that.
And I mean, related to that, and maybe it goes without saying, but I mean, one of the things about I think that the anxiety that any performer would have after early in one's career, it's about the anxiety or the worry or the nerves would be, am I going to remember the words? That happens for first of all, yes. And the chords. But after a while, what it comes down to, and for me too, is like, is this going to connect tonight?
Yeah. You know,
is this going to work? And I mean, but so that's a thing I work on.
Yes.
And it's taken me a long time to like really realize, like, as people sit down in their seats, they're on your side.
Yeah.
Like they're not there because they're not on your side.
Totally.
Like, you know, they're there to enjoy with you. So, but you know, but I think as a person who creates this stuff, you want so badly for it to land well that you know the nerves are good. Like I almost think if you're not worrying, well, you should go be an investment banker because like you have to worry a bit. Like you have to be invested in the music, you know, to the point where you're like, oh God, I really hope this works with these folks tonight. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
What you said a little bit ago about having the song carry you when you're not necessarily on top of your game or well, really in all times, letting the song carry you makes me think of what you're saying, finishing it. It's so worthwhile. It really justifies giving the song its due and keeping going until you've got that sense of like, oh yes, I am. I do believe in this being finished. I do believe that this spark is still here. I do believe that this is its strongest thing because then that song has the sturdiness and the ability to carry you and the other people.
Yeah.
And so it's well worth putting in that time at the outset.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and it's funny, like, and sometimes those songs, like the song will finish with the spark. Sometimes that happens very easily. And sometimes you really have to work at it. But I think I was just very lucky in that one of the first ones I recorded and released, to go back to the song about Mrs. Bell, like it's still probably one of my most requested songs. Mm. And it was one of the first ones I ever released. And it's so weird how this is now, that was 2006, like we're a lot of years later. Like, you know, I'm dating myself here. But I mean, after all those years, I can still sing that song and have it feel like the first time. Like, and so awesome. What it goes to, it's speaking right to what you just said, is that when you can get a song that somehow you feel once it's done that like it's got the magic in it, each night you go out there like it can carry itself and it can carry you, and it's such a gift, you know? It's such a treat.
Love that. Love that. Well, congratulations on having been able to write so many songs that do have that magic and have touched people so much. I love you as a singer-songwriter. And I really enjoy you as a person so much.
Well, thanks. I've loved this chat. This was fantastic.
I really thank you so much for being here. This has been such a joy. And I've got to let you go. But before I do, I would love to ask, what's something that is saving your life these days? It might be a thing you're doing or people or a group of people or something you're reading or watching.
Two things. Here's what comes to mind. Oh, there's sunbeams coming out of my face now.
two things.
One is running. Running probably more than ever is like this thing. I need it. I need to run. I need to clear my head. I need to make my heart tick faster. Like it feels so good, and it keeps me grounded. Reminds me that I'm human, and you know, I love it. Another one I have to say, like I fell in love 3 months into the pandemic, and my partner Michael is like, he's been like he's been a godsend. Like, love has changed me fundamentally as a person, and I think love is saving me. It's been absolutely wonderful. I'm stupidly in love. I could go on about it forever, but I'm a very lucky guy. I'm a very lucky guy, and love has been lovely.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, congratulations to you both.
Well, thanks.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please leave us a rating wherever you're listening and share it with someone who you think may like it, too. You can find me on Instagram at Timothy Lenko and at Timothy Lenko Music. Jeffrey, where can people find you and your music and follow you and what you're doing?
So I have a brand new, updated, snazzy website. They should go there. It's jeffstraker.com. And all the social media icons are at the top and bottom of the page, so they can find all the things there. But I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok and all those things too. So yeah, follow along. And specifically, I would love it if people kept an eye out for the new record, Great Big Sky, releasing in early June.
Yes. Oh, I can't wait for it. I'm really excited. That'll be a summer playlist.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for being here, Jeffrey. Really enjoyed this.
Thank you. This has been really lovely.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening. I'll be back again in just 1 week with a brand new episode. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye.